Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. You know, if you really want to understand how a global crisis can dismantle a society, you often need to look beyond just the science, right? Look at the bigger picture.
That's right.
Today, we're immersing ourselves in Alan Whiteside's really important work, HIV/AIDS. A very short introduction.
Yeah, and our mission today is to understand why this virus, HIV, became, well, almost the definition of a modern global catastrophe. Whiteside isn't just walking us through the history.
Yeah.
He's really forcing us to see that HIV/AIDS is fundamentally a social and economic, a political crisis. It's
right.
A disaster kind of engineered by inequality.
And this isn't just history class stuff, is it? I mean, the story of the AIDS pandemic, how it spread, the impact, the world's frankly, delayed but eventually powerful response. Mm-hmm. It's like a manual, isn't it, for navigating pretty much any crisis we face today, whether that's climate change or, you know, future pandemics. It shows exactly how these global threats find the cracks we've already built into our societies.
Exactly. It's a tough story in many ways, a story of human failure, definitely, driven by denial and stigma. But it's also one of eventually this hard-won success,
mm-hmm.
you know, rooted in science, but also incredible collective action.
So this deep dive is really about those lessons, the ones we can't afford to forget.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's maybe unpack who Alan Whiteside is first, because his background, well, it gives this analysis its critical edge, doesn't it?
It really does.
He's not a virologist, not a medical doctor. He is, importantly, a distinguished health economist.
And that perspective is just, it's everything here. Whiteside spent decades looking at the practical, the tangible damage of the epidemic. He was the founding director of HERD, that's the Health Economics and AIDS Research Division in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa.
Which was, tragically, the global epicenter of the pandemic for years.
Right at the heart of it. So his focus, his expertise, it isn't on what the virus is doing inside a T cell.
Right.
It's about what the epidemic does to a family's income, to a country's GDP, what it does to a school system or a hospital's ability to function. He's looking at the disease like a shockwave hitting the financial and social infrastructure.
So it's less about the virus attacking the body and more the epidemic attacking the very fabric of society.
Precisely. He tracks the damage to institutions, you know, labor productivity, even the stability between generations.
Yeah.
It's this data-driven socioeconomic view that's essential because it moves the conversation from pure biology to policy, to what we do about it.
Okay, so that brings us neatly to the book's main argument. Whiteside is essentially saying HIV/AIDS is this multifaceted global crisis, right? A developmental catastrophe that completely shook up global governance and changed how we think about human rights in relation to health.
Yeah, and he structures the book quite brilliantly, I think. Mm-hmm. It starts with the science, you know, making it accessible what the virus actually
mm-hmm.
is. But then it zooms out fast,
mm-hmm.
covers the history, the epidemiology.
Mm-hmm.
But crucially, the real weight of the book is on that devastating real-world socioeconomic impact.
So it's quite a journey for the reader. You start, like, at the microscopic level with the biology.
Mm-hmm.
You trace its identification back in the 80s, that whole difficult period,
mm.
and then, bang, you're grappling with the deep societal trauma,
yep.
falling life expectancy, workforces being decimated.
Exactly. And then that journey wraps up with this really careful analysis of the huge global response that eventually came together. The revolutionary science, yes, but also the relentless activism and that unprecedented political mobilization that finally created enough momentum to start turning the tide.
So it sounds like an essential primer, really, whether you're a student, maybe someone in policy, or just, you know, a curious learner wanting to grasp the full picture.
Absolutely, the full scope of the challenge.
Okay, let's dive into some of those key insights then, maybe starting with the science and history. Because there are still some misconceptions floating around, aren't there?
There really are.
So for anyone listening, what's the basic difference between HIV and AIDS?
Okay, yeah, this clarity is vital. So HIV is the human immunodeficiency virus. It's a specific type of virus called a retrovirus, and its main target is these crucial immune cells, the CD4 plus T cells. Think of them as the generals directing your immune system's army.
Right.
HIV attacks and destroys these generals. And over time, as their numbers drop, the whole immune system starts to collapse.
Okay, so that's the virus. What about AIDS?
AIDS acquired immunodeficiency syndrome. That's the official diagnosis for the lead stage of the infection. It's the clinical condition that results from that immune system collapse.
So AIDS isn't like a separate bug or disease. It's the result of HIV making the body vulnerable.
It's exactly right. The collapse allows for what are called opportunistic infections and certain cancers like Kaposi sarcoma, things that a healthy immune system would normally fight off easily, to take hold. So people die with AIDS from these complications, not strictly from HIV itself. The tragedy is the body just can't defend itself anymore.
And tracing where HIV came from, that was a complex process, scientifically and socially. What's the accepted origin now?
Yeah, the scientific consensus is very clear now. It was a zoonotic jump, meaning it jumped from animals to humans.
Okay.
Specifically, HIV originated from SIV, that's simian immunodeficiency virus, which is found naturally in African primates, like chimpanzees and Sodimangabees. The jump likely happened in Central Africa, probably through bushmeat hunting, you know, butchering infected animals.
And this was way back.
Probably in the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. And then likely spread quietly, maybe along trade routes, transport routes, for decades before it became noticeable globally.
And then when it hit the West, particularly in the early 1980s, the social reaction was just explosive. That early confusion, the intense stigma. Wasn't it initially called Griardie?
It was. Gay-related immune deficiency, which was incredibly damaging, obviously.
You're socially stigmatized.
That was a terrible public health failure. That whole association with the so-called 4-H club, Haitians, homosexuals, hemophiliacs, and heroin users. I mean, it was just awful stigmatization.
And dangerous, presumably, because it let the virus spread unnoticed elsewhere.
Absolutely. It allowed denial to take root. People outside those groups thought, oh, this isn't about me. Facing a terrifying diagnosis was hard enough without all the prejudice piled on top. It cost time and it cost lives.
Okay, let's shift to the epidemiology then, because this is where Whiteside's background as a health economist really comes into play, contrasting how the epidemic unfolded so differently around the world.
Yeah, he draws a really important distinction. He talks about the concentrated epidemics, mostly seen in places like North America and Europe. There, transmission was mainly within specific key populations, men who have sex with men, or MSM, and people who inject drugs.
Right, affecting certain groups more heavily.
Exactly. But then you contrast that with the devastating generalized epidemic that took hold in sub-Saharan Africa. There, the virus became deeply entrenched and spread widely throughout the general heterosexual population. And Whiteside is emphatic. The reasons for that difference are rooted in social and economic structures, not just biology.
So what were those drivers in Africa?
Well, it's complex, obviously. Poverty played a huge role. Pre-existing high rates of other untreated sexually transmitted infections, which make HIV transmission easier. And then these complex social patterns, like migratory labor.
Explain that a bit more.
You had situations where large numbers of men would move, you know, hundreds of miles for work. In mines or on farms, separated from their wives and families for months, even years. This often led to temporary relationships, sometimes involving sex work, and then the virus would travel back home with them. It created these highly efficient pathways for transmission across communities.
And you also mentioned the status of women earlier. That feels critical.
Oh, it's absolutely critical. It's really the tragedy at the heart of the generalized epidemic. Whiteside shows very clearly how the low social status and economic dependence of many women severely limited their ability to protect themselves.
How so?
Well, their power to negotiate condom use or even refuse unwanted sex was often compromised. Doing so could risk losing economic support, being abandoned, or even facing violence. So inequality, particularly gender inequality, wasn't just incidental. It was the fuel that turned a containable virus into a raging wildfire.
And the impact. You used the phrase developmental catastrophe. Some of the statistics Whiteside cites are just staggering.
They're genuinely hard to comprehend. He documents how, in the worst affected countries, places like Botswana, Zimbabwe, Swaziland, life expectancy just plummeted. It dropped by 20 to 30 years in the space of a single decade.
20 to 30 years, let that sink in. That's like wiping out decades of progress in health and development overnight.
Completely. Imagine losing a quarter century of expected life across an entire generation. And think what that does to the structure of a society.
Yeah, what does it do?
Well, normally you have a population pyramid,
right?
Wide base of young people, narrowing towards the top with older people.
Mm-hmm.
In these countries, those pyramids started turning into chimneys. Or even coffins, as some call them. The most economically productive age groups, say 25 to 45, were just decimated.
You lose your workforce, essentially.
You lose your workforce, your teachers, your doctors, your farmers, your civil servants. It created this devastating crisis of millions of orphans, often raised by elderly grandparents who should have been supported themselves. It crippled public services, national economies, just a crushing loss of human capital.
Yeah, it's grim. But the story does shift, doesn't it, when we look at the global response, particularly the scientific breakthroughs?
Yes, thankfully. The major scientific turning point came in the mid-1990s. That was the introduction of HART.
HART.
Highly active antiretroviral therapy. It wasn't just one drug, it was a cocktail, usually three different drugs taken together. And the genius of the cocktail approach was that it hit the virus from multiple angles, making it much harder for HIV to develop resistance.
And this changed everything.
It fundamentally changed the game. It transformed HIV from what was almost certainly a death sentence into a manageable chronic illness, like diabetes, for example.
Mm-hmm.
People could live long, healthy lives with HIV if they had access to the treatment.
Right. That's the huge caveat. Because initially, HART was incredibly expensive, wasn't it?
Oh.
Tens of thousands of dollars per person per year, mostly available only in wealthy countries.
Exactly. So the next crucial chapter is how that treatment got to the millions who needed it in low-income countries.
And that involves activism.
Fierce, organized, incredibly strategic activism. Whiteside gives huge credit here. Groups like ACTUP, the AIDS Coalition, to unleash power, their slogan, silence death, became iconic.
They were very visible, very confrontational.
They were. But they weren't just shouting. They were smart. They learned the science. They understood pharmaceutical regulation, clinical trial design. They used confrontational tactics, yes, but backed it up with knowledge to force regulatory bodies like the FDA to speed up drug approvals and, crucially, to challenge the drug companies on pricing.
And that fight over pricing and patents, especially the battle in South Africa, that really shifted the global landscape for access to medicines, didn't it?
Completely reshaped it. It established precedents around compulsory licensing and generic production that benefited millions, not just for HIV, but for other diseases too. And all this public pressure, this activism, eventually led to massive political mobilization.
Right, because governments started to step up in a big way.
They did. The global community seemed to realize, maybe slowly but eventually, that this was just too big for traditional charity or piecemeal aid. And that led to the creation of these unprecedented global funding mechanisms.
Like the Global Fund.
Exactly. The Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, and also the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR.
What made them so different? Why were they game changers?
Well, their scale was huge, first off. Billions of dollars dedicated specifically to these diseases. But also, their structure was often quite innovative. They focused heavily on results and getting resources directly to programs on the ground, sometimes bypassing slower government bureaucracies if needed.
So more direct action.
More direct, more focused on delivery systems that actually worked. They managed to scale up life-saving drugs for millions of people in a relatively short time. It really proved that if you have sustained political will and you back it up with serious, dedicated funding, you can tackle these seemingly insurmountable global health challenges.
But, and Whiteside raises this point too, doesn't he? Doesn't that massive reliance on external funding, particularly from the U.S. through PEPFAR, create potential problems like dependency or what happens if donor priorities shift?
That's a really critical point. And yeah, Whiteside definitely explores that tension. PEPFAR and the Global Fund save millions of lives, no question. But the long-term challenge is building sustainable domestic health systems and securing ongoing commitment within the affected countries themselves.
Because success can lead to complacency.
Exactly. And relying solely on the goodwill of external donors isn't a secure foundation for long-term health security. It's an ongoing challenge.
Okay, let's try and synthesize some of the core lessons from Whiteside's work. It seems like they all circle back to this fundamental link between social justice and health outcomes. What stands out most for you?
For me, the biggest takeaway, the one that just underpins everything else, is that HIV/AIDS is driven by pre-existing societal vulnerabilities. The virus itself, biologically, might not discriminate, but societies absolutely do. The epidemic burns hottest where you already have high levels of poverty, where gender inequality is deeply entrenched, where human rights are weak or non-existent. These aren't just background factors. They are the epidemic's pathways.
So trying to treat the virus without tackling that underlying injustice is basically futile in the long run.
It's like trying to mop the floor while the tap is still running full blast. You'll never end the epidemic that way.
Okay, so that's theme one. And a second major theme seems to be the incredibly destructive power of stigma, that it's literally deadly.
Absolutely deadly. The fear, the denialism, the prejudice, they were arguably as destructive as the virus itself in the early years and still cause immense harm.
And we saw that play out politically too, didn't we?
Most tragically, yes.
Mm.
The political denialism in South Africa under President Thabo Mbeki stands out. Leaders questioning the established scientific link between HIV and AIDS. It delayed the rollout of life-saving antiretroviral drugs for years.
Which costs lives.
Hundreds of thousands of lives, according to studies. It's a stark reminder that fighting stigma isn't just about being nice. It's a fundamental public health intervention. It allows people to seek testing, get treatment, and live openly without fear of being ostracized or worse.
But amidst the bleakness, there's also this powerful story of success. Theme 3, the power of convergence.
Yes. The progress that was made is proof that hope isn't naive. It shows what happens when you get science, activism, and political will all pulling in the same direction.
Well, it wasn't just one thing.
No, it took all three. Brilliant scientists developing complex treatments, fearless activists demanding access and challenging power structures, and eventually, politicians and global institutions willing to commit serious resources. That coordinated, multi-pronged approach, that's the blueprint.
And then finally, there's Whiteside's crucial warning, theme 4, the very real danger of complacency.
Yeah, this is so important now. Because treatment has been so successful, particularly in wealthier parts of the world, the crisis has become somewhat invisible for many. There's this dangerous perception that, oh, AIDS is solved. It's over.
But it's not.
Far from it. Whiteside warns that sustaining the funding, ensuring treatment access continues, and crucially, protecting the rights of and reaching those still most marginalized, what we call key populations, like men who have sex with men, sex workers, people who use drugs, transgender people. These are ongoing struggles. We absolutely cannot afford to drop the ball now.
His writing really does distill so much complex history into these essential, memorable points. Let's maybe highlight a couple of quotes or core ideas that really capture his argument.
Okay, well, one that fundamentally reframes the whole issue is when he says something like, HIV/AIDS is not simply a health issue. It is a profound development crisis that has systematically unraveled decades of progress.
Yeah, that just instantly elevates it beyond the clinic, doesn't it? It puts it right at the center of national stability and progress.
Exactly. And then there's that really sharp line about the drivers. The virus does not discriminate, but societies do. Poverty, stigma, and inequality provide the pathways for HIV to travel and the fuel for the epidemic to burn.
That feels like the core aha moment about the structural issues. It's so clear.
It really is. And maybe we should also mention a key concept from the more modern response, something built on the science and advocacy he describes, treatment as prevention, or TASP.
Right, and the UU message.
Exactly. UU, which stands for undetectable equals untransmittable. This is the scientifically proven fact that a person living with HIV who is on effective antiretroviral therapy and maintains an undetectable viral load cannot sexually transmit the virus to others.
Which is huge, not just for prevention, but for fighting stigma, too.
Absolutely. It means treatment is prevention. They're two sides of the same coin now. It helps dismantle fear and allows people with HIV to live full lives without that constant worry of transmission.
So, thinking about practical applications, what can someone listening take away from this and perhaps apply in their own life or community? On a personal level, what's the takeaway?
Well, on a personal level, I think it really boils down to actively combating stigma wherever you encounter it. Understanding the basic facts that HIV is a manageable chronic condition now, that UU is real, that it's not spread through hugging or sharing cups.
Just knowing the facts.
Knowing the facts empowers you to have informed conversations, to correct misinformation, and just generally to promote dignity and respect for people living with HIV. It's about making sure that fear and ignorance don't create the conditions for the virus or indeed any health issue to thrive.
And then on a bigger, maybe global scale, Whiteside's analysis feels like required reading for anyone thinking about global crises.
Oh, absolutely. The fundamental lesson about global interconnectedness and shared responsibility is vital. You know, the idea that a disease threat anywhere really is a threat everywhere, that became crystal clear with HIV/AIDS.
And with COVID more recently.
Exactly. The infrastructure, the surveillance systems, the global health partnerships that were largely built or strengthened to fight AIDS are the very things we rely on now for other global health emergencies, including pandemic preparedness and even things like tackling antibiotic resistance or the health impacts of climate change.
And there's a strong policy message, too, isn't there, about protecting marginalized groups?
A very powerful one. Whiteside's work essentially proves, with data and lived experience, that protecting the rights and health of the most marginalized populations, whether that's the LGBTQ plus community, people who use drugs, sex workers, migrants. It's not just, you know, a nice thing to do or a purely moral issue. It is an absolute public health imperative.
Because marginalization creates vulnerability.
Precisely. Marginalization literally creates the conditions where diseases can spread unchecked.
Mm-hmm.
So protecting rights is protecting public health. It's that simple and that profound.
So as we wrap up, what's maybe one final thought or insight from Whiteside's work that really stuck with you? Something surprising, perhaps?
For me, I think it's the powerful reminder that complexity matters. That might sound obvious, but in the face of huge crises, there's always this temptation to look for simple silver bullet solutions.
Right. Just do X and it'll be fixed.
Exactly. Just hand out condoms or just provide the pills. But Whiteside shows that against a challenge so deeply rooted in social inequality, those single dimension approaches are almost guaranteed to fail or at least fall short. You have to embrace the complexity. You need multi-sectoral approaches, things that address rights, education, poverty, gender dynamics, as well as the biomedical side. It has to be holistic.
That makes sense. For me, I think the final thought is one of, well, earn hope, I suppose. Looking back at the sheer terror and devastation of the 80s and early 90s, and then seeing the progress made, transforming this death sentence into a manageable condition for millions, thanks to this incredible convergence of science, activism, and eventually political will, It just proves that even the most daunting global challenges aren't insurmountable. That with sustained solidarity, with courage, with ingenuity, we can overcome them. That success story, as you said, is still being written, but the progress is undeniable.
And Whiteside's book does such a brilliant job of making sure those hard-won lessons aren't lost, that they're accessible and actionable for all of us, really.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.